Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the State House Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of October 1st, 2019. This week, we look at a scheme within a scheme. An upstate law firm played a key role in a scheme to prey on financially strapped military veterans and also misled investors, while leading to millions in alleged profits. Interact with us on Twitter or Instagram at @SCLeadPod about this episode, guys. We want to hear from you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. Also, make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can rate and review us there. And if you subscribe, you'll never miss us. We'll be on your phone every week. We're also everywhere podcasts exist, including NPR One. Now, you can listen to all four sections of our podcast instead of debating the nuances of federal whistleblower laws and the hell void that is Twitter up into the wee hours of the morning. Are you changing minds? Let us know. Or as you realize how many years of your life are gone due to the stress of being a football fan. That's why I only follow dressage, my good man. That's right, horse dance. Yes, perfect for my worry lines. Exactly, what worry lines? Oh, now for that quorum call, Bella. Oh, <terrible. laughs> Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. And we're only giving you three this week because we got a longer conversation and a lot of campaign trail news. Your time is valuable. Number one, the State House report reports that South Carolina has slightly fewer children living in concentrated poverty now compared to 5 years earlier. But 12%, which is about 1 in 8 children, still remain in high poverty areas. This is according to new data from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. According to the report, 18,000 fewer children lived in concentrated poverty when comparing data from the years 2008 to 2012 versus 2013 to 2017. Concentrated poverty refers to a neighborhood that has 30% or more of its population living in poverty. It's defined as annual income of $31,380 for a family of four. Number two, the Post and Courier reports that a cell phone micro-jamming test inside Broad River Correctional in Columbia showed that inmates' calls can be blocked without affecting law enforcement or civilian signals. This according to a federal report. South Carolina Department of Corrections Director Brian Sterling has sought permission from the Federal Communications Commission for years to block signals, only to be stymied by opposition from the industry, which contends that jamming devices could interfere with cell phones on the outside. And number three, State Superintendent of Education Molly Spearman announced $11.8 million in new funding for 205 school resource officers, SROs, and that will be in schools that currently lack coverage. Now, this money was in the budget lawmakers approved in May for the current fiscal year. This money goes to 81 traditional public school districts, as well as the Erskine Charter Institute and South Carolina Public Charter School District will receive funds to pay for 1 to 4 new officers, depending on the district's needs. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week we give you a headline, a little taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. Headline, Florida Man's murder plot against wife backfires after he's left paralyzed. That's Shakespeare right there. And just like Clemson falling all the way down, oh, way down on the AP poll to number two, we buried the lead. Go, go Cox, go Cox. A recent project by the Post and Courier found that an upstate law firm was connected to a troubling scheme that preyed upon financially struggling military veterans looking to sell their rights to their monthly pension and disability payments for a drastically smaller one-time lump sum. The scheme also misled investors and led to millions in alleged profits. Andy Brown joins us from the Charleston Newsroom to explain what he uncovered in his story, Red, White, and Fooled, which led the Sunday Front on September 20th. Andy, thanks for making time today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we miss you up here in Columbia. We got a new star chart up here. We got to get you up here to put some more stars on the
Man,
chart.
Man, I want my stars shipped express mail down here, okay? I need them for my desk.
We will send it to you. You can send it back and we'll put it on the board.
Okay.
But Andy, kind of sad to talk with you about this kind of troubling story that you recently reported on. Give us an overview of what this scheme was, how it worked, and how it used vulnerable military veterans who needed quick cash to kind of stay afloat.
So this scheme has been going on, or whatever you want to call it, many veterans consider it a scam, and it's been going on for about 7 years now, from what I can tell from records that I obtained from some lawsuits and regulatory matters. And what it shows is that this group of people, including Miss Candy Kern Fuller, who is an attorney from Greenville, has been involved in this operation that convinces some financially strapped veterans to essentially like deed over their military pensions or their VA disability payments that they receive on a monthly basis in return for a lump sum cash payout. And so the veterans in return will sign over, say, 6 to 10 years of their future benefit payments to these people. On the opposite end, this operation then takes those contracts from the veterans and markets them to retirees and other investors and says, we need you to put up the lump sum payment for these veterans, and then you will receive their benefits for the next 8 years or however long they signed over their benefits for. And in that way, they're promising these investors who live all over the country up to an 8% return on their money. The whole thing, from according to state and federal officials, however, this whole operation is illegal because unlike some corporate pensions and other benefits, you can't assign your military pension or disability payments. And so the whole contracts from the get-go, according to state and federal officials, is illegal. And the contract should be void. But as I reported, Ms. Candy Kern Fuller and her law firm, the Upstate Law Group, have used the state's court system here in South Carolina to validate these contracts that federal officials now say should have never been signed to begin with.
You're saying these things never should have happened. But in the wake of all this, they've been dealing with a lot of different veterans that have had to declare bankruptcy in some situations because they are threatened under lawsuit, and they have been taken to court in some cases to continue paying these payments because they do get this lump sum money report. And then, of course, unfortunately, in some cases, they're still strapped for money because they can't get jobs because they're disabled or a multitude of other factors. So they end up, not sending their checks to the group, and that's how they end up kind of being caught in this contract that tells them that they have to do that even though they still don't have the money to operate?
These veterans who are signing these things are already in financial trouble, right? They either have, you know, some other a medical problem, or like anybody in the United States, you know, there's debt that they have in some regard. And so they're hoping, you know, they're out there, they're desperate, they're searching for some way to get some money now. The problem is that after they get the money, they start to realize the terms of the deal in many instances, and they're like, wait, I just spent all this money that they gave me, you know, giving it to their creditors, these veterans, and then they're still out of money, and they no longer have that monthly payment coming in from the federal government that they were relying on. So in many, many cases, from what I can tell, according to court records and some regulatory filings all over the country, veterans default on these things. Meaning they pull back their military pensions or disability payments, and that leaves investors on the opposite end of this scheme in the lurch. They're no longer seeing the deposits arrive in their bank accounts for these monthly payments, and the lump sum, sometimes several hundred thousand dollars that they handed over to several veterans for lump sum payments, that's gone as well. And so you're starting to see investors also recognize here in the last like 3 or 4 years, these schemes defrauded them as well, and they're suing in federal court.
So it sounds like just one giant mess is what it is. But and I'm wondering how the mess got to continue the way it is, especially if this is something that shouldn't have been legal in the first place. I mean, how are retirees, how are investment groups selling these instruments to people when they know that up front what's happening on the front end of this isn't legal in the first place?
So
did you ever get it to the bottom of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing, right? It really shows, I think this story more than anything else shows the breakdown of financial enforcement in the United States. So this group of people who have been running this operation, since 2013, they have gone through several different business names. Intermittently, states like Arkansas and Texas and California and Pennsylvania and Iowa, they would recognize this scheme as an illegal investment scheme, and they would send these companies cease and desist letters saying, you're no longer allowed to operate in our state. This scheme shouldn't be happening. Investors shouldn't be giving you their money. Veterans shouldn't be contracting over their pensions and disability payments. But often what happened then is the companies would just switch names. So they'd drop whatever company got cited in Arkansas, and they would create a new company. And so over the past 7 years, you had, I'm going to try to remember all these companies, Voyager Financial Group, Sobel Corporation, BAIC Inc., you had Performance Arbitrage Company, and then the latest iteration was something called Life Funding Options, which was actually based here in Greenville, South Carolina, very close to where Candy Kern Fuller operates the Upstate Law Group and her law practice there. So what it shows is more recently, you know, federal regulators have started to come down on some of these players and order them through the federal court system not to operate in this manner anymore. But it took 7 years. And Ms. Kern Fuller and the Upstate Law Group to this point have been essentially left unscathed. They are being investigated, but to this point, they have not admitted any guilt and they have not been cited to stop this operation. And so it shows the breakdown whenever states operate in silos, right? Just because a securities regulator in Texas cited someone doesn't mean the operation is shut down, especially if you're preying on veterans and investors in all 50 states. You know, this was a nationwide scheme. I've seen contracts for veterans selling over their benefits from Texas and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Alaska, South Carolina. I interviewed a guy here from South Carolina who's deeded over his pensions and disability or his disability payments and then came to regret it, had to default, and that's whenever, you know, he really started to get into trouble with the law firm in the upstate.
And Andy, like, it's interesting to me because we are post-Great Recession, we're post all these financial institutions that were on the brink of collapsing and some that did, and, you know, there's the big push for more regulations and such, but here we are in 2019, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is still under a lot of fire, it's kind of been gutted if you wanted to describe it like that. Some of these things that kind of came out of the financial crisis that were meant to protect people from these investments, you know, from things that can lead to financial ruin because they sound too good to be true or you're trying to make a quick buck. So I'm wondering, you know, you're talking about the state of the financial industry at this point. Is there a reason maybe why this was allowed to keep going, or there's a reason why that South Carolina maybe was a good place for this to continue? You're talking about getting validation in the courts too. I'm just wondering if it's just, is it just they got lucky that they could keep like switching names and making things work, or was there something more going on there?
You know, and you have to remember, this wasn't just under the Trump administration. This thing operated from what I can tell, at least from late the 2012 time point up until earlier this year, whenever Life Funding Options was ordered by the state of South Carolina and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at the federal level to cease their operations. But it just shows how long this can go on. I don't know if it's, I think it does say something about the effectiveness of the federal and state regulation on these matters, because these people were able to prey on a lot of different people. And it's not like there wasn't paperwork on them, right? There were at least 8 states cited these various companies for securities violations, and multiple lawsuits in federal court were filed by investors in California and Pennsylvania. You know, those ended in secrets in settlements from what I can tell. But the operation just perpetuated itself. And even whenever one of the main players kind of got pushed to the side because his name had been attached to too many state citations, this group of people just continued.
So that's the thing, Andy. Like, so was the Upstate Law Group kind of like the nexus of it, and they were dealing with all these other LLCs with different names? So maybe it was kind of hard for other states to connect the dots to everyone being in one connected group, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, it gets a little hard, right? Because they don't admit that they're tied. And I'm basing a lot of my information off a case in Arizona that has kind of, through some of this evidence of late, has tied a lot of these people together. But, you know, I think we should talk about the Upstate Law Group because they had a very unique role in all of this. This isn't the only type of operation that happened like this in the country. Currently, there's another man from California and some of his partners who are facing federal fraud charges up in Greenville County federal court. So these types of operations have resulted in criminal charges. This group just hasn't faced that yet. But the Upstate Law Group was unique in all of this. And Candy Kern Fuller, who is an attorney, licensed attorney up in Greenville and other parts of the state, she played a unique role because she was, as I describe her in the story, she was the banker for the operation. She was the legal counsel for parts of the operation. And she was also the debt collector for parts of the operation. And I base that all off of records that I obtained from Arizona and other federal court cases. But essentially, her law firm, the Upstate Law Group, acted as the escrow account where all of this money from the federal government through the VA disability payments and the pensions were wired. And then it was also the place that the investors wired their money so that the lump sum payments could be handed out to the veterans.
Like a clearinghouse, essentially, for everything was
All of the money went through Greenville and the Upstate Law Group's bank accounts. Then, you know, she helped, from what I can understand in Arizona, she helped to draft the contracts that they used to sell these things to investors. And then the oddest part, I think, of what I uncovered in the story was whenever the deals went sour, whenever the veterans stopped paying on these contracts, she was the person who also stepped in, and her law group was the company that stepped in to sue them in Greenville County Court. The contract that all of these veterans signed had a clause in there that said essentially any legal dispute that arises over these contracts is going to be handled in Greenville County Circuit Court. That's in her backyard, obviously. And what it caused was this huge disadvantage for the veterans, many of whom, again, were from far corners of the country, who, one, were already hard up, couldn't hire a defense attorney in many cases.
And they're not going to get to Greenville Circuit
right.
Court.
And they're not going to get to Greenville. And so what it resulted in early on, at least, were several judges in Greenville County being presented with these contracts. The Upstate Law Group and Candy Kern Fuller would say, you know, we've served these veterans. They're not here in court. And a couple months later, they would say, we move for summary judgment, meaning we don't want a jury trial now. We think that you, judge, should rule because this veteran is not here in court. And so you should rule and give us not only the money that they say is owed in the contract, you should give us damages as well for them breaking this contract.
If it wasn't legal, I mean, are judges like, should a judge know that that wasn't a legal contract in the first place, that they couldn't sign these benefits over? I mean, that's...
I didn't get to speak with the judges who did this, but I assume they were ruling based on what was presented to them.
Just on this contract. Yeah, they don't know all the ins and outs or what this money's tied to, perhaps.
Right, and maybe not fully looking at the underlying contract. They were just ruling on what was on the paper. And on paper, it says that the veteran owes this.
Yeah, you owe me this, and it's a breach of contract.
If these veterans had hired defense attorneys, it would have came out. Their defense attorneys would have stood in court and said, these contracts are void from the get-go. You cannot assign federal pensions or disability payments for veterans, and they would have gotten it dismissed. And some veterans I spoke with actually got these contracts dismissed in bankruptcy, ones that were smart enough to understand that after they started realizing that the contracts never should have been offered to them to begin with. And so federal bankruptcy judges dismissed this out of hand and said, you can't collect on that. But, you know, these veterans who didn't have legal representation, who were being sued hundreds of miles away from their home, I can only imagine the stress that they were under. So they never show up in court. And the one instance that really stuck out in my mind the most of these cases was from 2013-2014 timeframe. A veteran from Kentucky who received, I think it was somewhere around $40,000 or so, through this lump sum payment from an investor, ends up breaking the contract, not continuing his payments. He gets sued in Greenville County Court. And as a result, a judge rules that he not only owes the money that he agreed to pay in the contract, he owes over $500,000. You're talking $500,000-something, where this man got like $40,000.
And Andy, just kind of wrapping up, I mean, you know, where does this go from here? Where does this case go? And have you had any updates since publishing this story?
At this point, the Upstate Law Group is still, you know, they're not facing any type of criminal charges. They are under pressure on multiple fronts. The Arizona Corporation Commission, which regulates securities, is still pursuing a case against them for essentially operating as an illegal investment. Then you have a group of veterans who sued Candy Kern Fuller and the Upstate Law Group and these other business people in federal court here in South Carolina. And they are close to reaching a settlement, from what I understand, that could force these people to stop operating in this type of way ever again. That is yet to be ruled on by a judge or presented. And then there's still the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which asked a question Miss Candy Kern Fuller in August, and she moved to actually kill that subpoena by arguing that the entire federal agency was unconstitutional. I've not seen anything further come of that, She was successful in not being questioned by them, from what I understand. But it seems their investigation continues. So,
and someone was arrested too, right, connected to the scheme?
That was actually a different scheme. So, yes, there's a lot going on. There's two different schemes that are being pursued here in South Carolina. The one is already charged federally, which is that's the California man who was arrested last week. And then there's the Upstate Law Group and its partners who are still being pursued in civil court and, you know, being investigated by some of the top consumer watchdogs in the country. So it's going to take a little bit of time for all of this to roll out, but I don't think the story is over yet.
Yeah, very interesting stuff and very detailed, intricate financial dealings here. And again, you know, like so many things in not only in finance, but in life, a lot of times, if it's too good to be true, it usually is. And, you know, that goes for the investors and for these poor veterans, too, that were kind of left in a lurch. So, Andy Brown, thanks for this great story. This unfortunate story, but very well done story. And you can read the whole story on postingcourier.com and in our show notes on scetv.org/sclead. Thanks for joining us, Andy.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020 related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. Leading off, we got fresh,
exciting.
No? Cool in the gang? Anyone? It's not for everyone. Poll numbers. A CNN SSRS poll of 406 likely South Carolina Democratic primary voters found that 37% supported former Vice President Joe Biden. As Senator Elizabeth Warren came in at 16%, and Senator Bernie Sanders trailed her at 11%. And then we saw Mayor Pete Buttigieg move up to fourth place with 4%, whereas Senator Kamala Harris tied with Tom Steyer at 3%. A lot of interesting moves there. It's worth noting that Warren and Sanders are within the 5.9-point margin of error. This poll was conducted from September 22nd through September 26th, and that was a time when Harris was campaigning in Charleston and also attended Emily Clyburn's funeral with Warren on Sunday. Now, Biden attended the Monday services as well. And Sanders rallied in Rock Hill on Friday the 20th, just before the poll went into the field. We got some more takes we're going to break down for you next week, too. Speaking of Steyer, the billionaire activist, he's out with a nearly $2 million early state digital ad buy, which includes South Carolina. Warren's campaign also announced an eight-figure TV and digital ad buy in Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina.
You get ready, because the ads, they're coming.
First Congressional District Congressman Joe Cunningham has seen a major fundraising boost since the National Republican Campaign Committee attacked his wife Amanda on Twitter about whether an Instagram post where she said she supported Beto O'Rourke would come up in their marriage counseling. In a previous post, Amanda lamented the fact that congressional health insurance doesn't cover couples therapy. The NRCC tweet was widely condemned by Democrats and Republicans. Look at that bipartisanship. Speaking of Cunningham, he is still hesitant about whether he would vote to impeach President Trump, per reporting from the Post and Courier. Cunningham has to walk a fine line as a moderate in the district that he narrowly flipped after four decades of being solidly Republican. And Mark Sanford, who was running for president, was campaigning outside of an Arby's in Des Moines. Very unique backdrop. And he used a beef sandwich, a beef cheddar sandwich to be specific, as a prop when he quoted the old Wendy's catchphrase, "Where's the beef?" in reference to President Donald Trump's policies. This declaration prompted Arby's to tweet at Sanford saying, "Sir, this is an Arby's."
Come on, Mark. Wendy's got the beef. Arby's got the meats. But we all got meat sweats.
Also, if you want some more spicy Sanford hot takes, follow his former chief of staff, Scott English, on Twitter at @IamScottEnglish. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is here for some state trivia? He is. Welcome, Russ.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
What you got us for this week?
Well, do you remember a year or so ago we posed the question of what is the largest county in South Carolina?
Mm-hmm.
You're still a bit.
I'm still getting fan mail interactions face to face, but I tell them, you know, it's not about the size of the county; it's about the number of people in that county. Because really, when it comes down to it, we're all South Carolinians, despite you know, our geographical boundaries, you know, our political differences.
Okay.
And together we can change this country one vote at a time. That's why Russ McKinney has more trivia for us.
Yeah. The correct answer, which you didn't get, was Horry County, Horry, which is at the bottom of this whole episode. So our question today is, what is the smallest county?
Again, size doesn't matter. It's all about, we're all one South Carolina. Two Carolinas, one team. Did I, wrong context. Keep it going, Russ.
Okay.
That's enough of me today.
Possible answers in alphabetical order.
Let me just Google really quick. Yes.
A, Allendale County. B, Bamberg County. C, Calhoun County. D, McCormick County.
Oh, jeez. I've been in a few of those counties. I'm not going to say which because I don't disclose my travel details.
And again, we're we're talking about area, not population.
Yeah. Allendale, Bamberg,
Calhoun, McCormick.
McCormick. Mm. Yeah, Bamberg. I mean, I'm thinking Bamberg. I'm also thinking McCormick. And I don't think I've been to McCormick County.
Well, you don't go through McCormick County. You have to go to McCormick County.
Oh, yeah,
which is you go through McCormick County, you're in Georgia.
Yeah, let's throw McCormick County a bone here. Okay. But I want to also say Bamberg, but continue, Russ.
Okay, the answer is C, Calhoun County.
You do kind of drive through Calhoun County there for a little bit. It's a little blip, because it's like Orangeburg, you know, you're in Orangeburg for like a day, essentially, and then you're in Richland, you know?
Right, it's between Columbia and Charleston. The county seat, of course, is St. Matthews. But if you want to talk about smallest county by population, Calhoun County does not have the smallest population. That belongs to Allendale County.
Where they, that would have been the trick question.
2018 estimated census count population of 9,045, as opposed to Greenville County, 2018 census estimation, 514,000. So we look at the disparity between two counties. We have the two counties, I believe, that are below 10,000 in population. And then a county like Greenville with over a half million. It causes some of the problems that you see the General Assembly trying to grapple with. Mm-hmm. They have these huge differences in counties. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing, some would say maybe unfortunate thing, the smaller counties, like all of those we mentioned earlier, are getting smaller. The larger counties are getting larger.
And yeah, weren't we talking about that too a while ago about possible consolidation if need be? I mean, we can barely consolidate school districts in this state. I can't even imagine what a county being absorbed would be like.
I keep waiting for someone to mention that, but I've not run across anybody advocating that yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be interesting because if you look at the county formations in South Carolina, counties like Bamberg, they came out of original larger counties like Orangeburg, Aiken, things like that. So you got to wonder at some point, would they conceivably go back in to those counties? But again, I've not heard anyone really out there advocating that.
A lot of money costs associated with that kind of stuff, too, especially
You know, one county would give up a county seat and a sheriff and a coroner and a county council. And so it's,
when I think about it. But something to think about for sure. Thanks, Russ, for that insightful trivia.
Sure.
And, you know, guys in Calhoun County, don't be like guys in Horry County. Let it go. Let it go. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. It helps other people find us, guys. You can follow us on Instagram at @scleadpod, and you can see photos from the studio on assignment and, of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @scledepod. We have swag, sticker swag, that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes or emojis to scledepod@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia, September 30th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. I'm enjoying the fall weather, but it's hard to whisper sarcasm.
Hot! Still so hot, it's October!